And there he was at the Berlin Wall. They put him up in this big bucket crane above the crowd, which was tens and tens of thousands of people cheering. And they played the backing track of this song, and he sung it live. And he was wearing this amazing, sparkly leather jacket that had all these lights on it. It was one of the weirdest moments in Cold War musical history.
Welcome to My Nuclear Life. I'm Shelley Lesher. Music is something that sticks in my head. It always surprises me that I can remember every word to a song I last heard decades before. And it conjures up emotions and feelings associated with that song or time period. So it's no wonder that songwriters and musicians have used it to process, explain, and protest nuclear war and nuclear weapons. That's the subject of today's podcast. I'm excited to have two guests with me, Tim and Joanna Smolko, the authors of a new book, Atomic Tunes. Tim is a librarian at the University of Georgia. His last book, Jethro Tull's Thick as a Brick and a Passion Play, won the Best Book on Recorded Rock Music from the Association for Recorded Sound Collections. Joanna holds a PhD in musicology and is an instructor of music at the Hugh Hodgkin School of Music at the University of Georgia. She was a contributing editor for the second edition of the Grove Dictionary of American Music. But personally, I have to add, if you grew up watching the antics of Bugs Bunny and Friends, you have to read the paper she wrote about the intersection of race and place in Looney Tunes cartoons. You would think a podcast is the perfect place to discuss music. Turns out there are a lot of copyright restrictions, which prevent me from embedding the songs into this episode. To help you, there's a Spotify song list and some YouTube links on the show's webpage, mynuclearlife.com. There is one notable exception, and that's Tom Lehrer, who has released his music into the public domain. Stay tuned to the end of the podcast, where we will play one of his most popular songs. Before we get started, I wanted Tim and Joanna to explain their book, which, if you are listening to this episode on the day it drops, coincides with the release of their book, Atomic Tunes.
Our book is called Atomic Tunes, The Cold War in American and British Popular Music, and it's coming out in May. We spent 7 years listening to all these songs about the Cold War, analyzing the lyrics and the music, and we go into some of the stories and how they were written and biographical elements of the songwriters and how they intersected with Cold War issues. The book is organized according to musical style. So we have two chapters on folk music, a chapter on country music and comedy songs and rock songs, punk, heavy metal, electronic. We're very excited about it, and you will learn a lot of fun things about the Cold War, things you never heard before.
So part of the reason we organized it by genre as well as chronology is that we found the combination of the two, the style plus the time period it's from, really shaped the messages and the themes of the songs. So if you go to country music, you're going to have a very different perspective on nuclear weapons and warfare and the U.S.'s role in the world than you might have from a punk song. And if you map onto that time period, say the 50s versus the 70s or 80s, you get an even more precise picture of these big themes. And I also want to say that the book, we're not just writing it to musicologists. We try to avoid unnecessary jargon in our writing so that if you are just an amateur historian and interested in these topics, if you're a musician, if you're somebody who's studying world history, if you're studying popular music, or just are really interested in how music shapes our culture and history, this book is something that you may be interested in. And like the songs themselves, we try to walk a fine line between the seriousness of these issues and the humor that is used to diffuse the situation.
I read a couple of chapters of Atomic Tunes. I am neither a musician nor a musicologist. I mean, really, I can't read music or play a tune on any instrument whatsoever. And I found these pages extremely interesting and understandable. So, all right, let's dig into some of these topics and some of these songs. Have you been able to identify the first song ever written about the atomic bomb?
Well, shortly after Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings in 1945 in August, there were two country artists who wrote songs and a folk artist. Of those three songs, the most probing is the one by the folk artist, and his name was Vern Partlow, and he wrote a song called Old Man Adam. It's also known as Atomic Talking Blues. He was a singer-songwriter. He was in the folk scene. He lived in Los Angeles, and he had an opportunity to interview some atomic scientists because he was also a news reporter, a journalist for the Los Angeles Daily News. He decided to write a song about the bomb. He tinkered with it for a few years. By 1950, some people were starting to record it, like Pete Seeger. You can't find his original version on YouTube, but you can find versions of the song by Pete Seeger, Sons of the Pioneers, and Sam Hinton on YouTube.
I found one by Sons of the Pioneers, I think, is the one that's easily accessible on YouTube.
The song was becoming sort of well-known in 1950, and then suddenly it disappeared from the shelves, and it wasn't heard on radio very often because some anti-communist groups put pressure on the record labels that were publishing the record. That it was a communist song, and it asked controversial questions about the bomb and the future of the arms race. And so it was not only one of the first songs about the bomb, it was one of the first songs about the bomb that was censored. Things died down after McCarthyism started to die down in the late 50s, but it was hard to come by in 1950. But now it's a remarkable song. It's Partlow's original version goes to 8 verses and 8 choruses, and there's a lot of information packed in there, and it really captures the tenor of the debate on how far should we go with nuclear testing and bombs and energy, and really captures the essential questions of the debate even today.
Yeah, I was surprised when I read that this song was from 1949, 1950, because he's calling for people to take action and has a lot of interesting points in the song that I didn't think were prevalent in that time period. He was asking for civilian international control of the bomb, which I thought only scientists were discussing. I didn't know it had made it to a popular song and was out in the public.
Yeah. Well, in 1946, a bunch of scientists got together. Some of them were Manhattan Project scientists. This included J. Robert Oppenheimer and Einstein and Niels Bohr. They published a collection of essays called One World or None. And Partlow name drops that book in the song. And there was also a 9-minute educational film made by the same group about the future of nuclear weapons. Another phrase that Partlow mentions in the song, which you mentioned, is international civilian control of the bomb. So this brings up a whole interesting debate about should the bomb be in control of the military or scientists or the United Nations? Should there be some international body that has control over how it all plays out? 100,000 copies of this book were published. It's really interesting how much information was disseminated about the bomb at that time. And then later on, it was more hush-hush about what might happen. So Partlow is very incisive. I'm sure he read the whole book and captures a lot of what the scientists were saying in the book about the future of the arms race.
When you read the lyrics to the song, it's obvious that he did a lot of research. There's a lot of facts in the song.
Exactly.
But I think I love the ending of the song where he says, "The people of the world must pick out a thesis, peace in the world or the world in pieces." I think that stands true today just as much as it did in 49.
Yeah. In the early 50s, the hydrogen bomb came along and the possibility of nuclear war of massive proportions was more and more a reality. So the song becomes more relevant and prescient as time goes on. And Partlow saw the future of it in 1945 when he wrote the song.
One of the most surprising things we found as we were writing the book is how relevant some of these issues have stayed. we might not talk about it as much these days, but is still a presence. And a lot of these issues continue, both scientific issues, right, as well as some of the frames. We're still using a lot of Cold War frames in the way that we talk about politics today.
Do we express ourselves in song against nuclear war or nuclear weapons as we did in previous decades?
No, not at all. I think nuclear weapons have pretty much been normalized. It's not a big deal anymore. Just last week, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists told us that we're still 100 seconds to midnight, which means the scientists think we're in great danger of either nuclear war or environmental catastrophe. But the public doesn't seem too worried about it, and they haven't been for decades. We're not worried about it today because we have so many other problems. With our book, we're like, oh, you know, there's still this whole nuclear weapons thing we have to worry about too, and here's all the songs you can listen to worry even more. But people are not writing songs today like they did back then.
When were the periods that you would see the most songs written about these topics?
It does go up and down. A lot of songs were written in the late 40s and early 50s. In 1949, the Soviet Union exploded their first atomic bomb. That made the arms race like a real thing. And then there's the Korean War. There's lots of Korean War songs. In the early 60s, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there were a lot of songs about that. A lot of songs about the Vietnam War, even though it didn't have anything to do with nuclear weapons, and neither side ever really considered using nuclear weapons. In the early 80s, there were a whole lot of songs about the continuation and the upsurge in the arms race when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and Reagan took a hard stance against the Soviet Union and greatly increased military spending and on nuclear weapons. So yeah, there's been some peaks and dips. I'd say the most songs were written in the early 80s. We just found hundreds and hundreds of songs in the early 80s.
Before we go into the 80s, because I definitely want to talk about the 80s, maybe because I remember a lot more of those songs. But there was a period in which there were a lot of women singer-songwriters. Could you tell me a little bit more about the female songwriters in the 60s?
Yes, it definitely peaked in the 1960s, although many of them, like Peggy Seeger, continued to write Cold War songs for many decades after that. First of all of these Cold War issues, they're not happening in a vacuum, right? They're happening alongside civil rights battles. They're happening alongside women's issues, the onset of different waves of feminism. All of it, we found, is very linked together. So there's a couple of songwriters that I really touch on in the book. The first I'd like to talk about is Joan Baez. Many of you have heard of her, but I don't know if as many know that her father was a scientist.
Really? What kind of scientist was her father?
He actually was an inventor. He co-invented the X-ray reflection microscope. Absolutely brilliant. And he was actively recruited to work on nuclear research, but he was a man of conscience and he felt like that was something he couldn't pursue. He actually converted to being a Quaker and turned down some prestigious fellowships to become a professor instead. And his influence on her growing up, I believe, was formative, both with her protests for peace, but also her value of science.
That's really interesting. I know Joan Baez as a folk singer, and she's even active today, but I had no idea that she had some sort of intersection with nuclear weapons.
So her first protest was actually during an air raid drill. In 1958, there was a planned drill for her high school in Palo Alto, California. Before this happened, she went home and did the math. She pulled down one of her dad's textbooks, figured out that the high school students were supposed to walk home. It would take her 3 miles, I believe, to walk home from her high school. And she knew that if there were a nuclear bomb drop, there was no time for that. So she simply sat in her seat when it was time for the air raid drill. And it was pretty controversial. The local newspapers picked it up and called her a communist, but it didn't make sense to her. So she just didn't comply. And I feel like this sets up a lot of work that she did within her career.
That makes sense, knowing that background. But still, I'm surprised that you would be called a communist because you decided that you'd rather just stay in your high school than walk home. Because why are you going to exert all that energy when you're just going to die anyway? Like, it seems ridiculous to be called a communist for that reason.
It does. And yet we see some of the same language still used today, right? We see over and over that accusations of being a communist or socialist are used against these songwriters, even when they're doing things like talking about civil rights. It's a very, I think, a resonant metaphor. It's definitely a fear tactic where all you have to do is say the word and it brings up, especially for people of that generation, just a very fearful stance.
It's just a way to discredit them with one word.
Exactly. Exactly. Another songwriter that we looked at is Malvina Reynolds, who's most famous, I think, for her song Little Boxes that's shown up in popular media.
Yes.
Yeah,
I know that song. My husband sings it to me when we go past certain towns when we're driving around. So yeah, I know Little Boxes.
So I find Malvina Reynolds inspiring because she actually didn't become a folk singer until her early 40s. Her parents were Jewish socialists, and they opposed the U.S. participation in World War I. And later on, they also were involved with civil rights issues, and they were attacked by the KKK, who came to their house and attempted to kidnap them. And this was a formative experience for Malvina Reynolds, even though she was in adulthood at that point. But she started to sing a lot of protest songs for women's rights, and also anti-war songs. One of the things that she participated in, which is something that I wish that had more attention on right now, is the Women's Strike for Peace movement.
I want to take a minute to describe the Women's Strike for Peace. In 1961, around 50,000 women in 60 cities marched to end the test of nuclear weapons. The root of these marches were in the traditional female culture and motherhood, as the majority of these women were from middle-class households and were married with children. They were able to rally around the dangers of atomic testing and strontium-90 because of a large citizen project called the Baby Tooth Survey. In this project, mothers were asked to send their children's baby teeth to the Washington University School of Dental Medicine to determine how much strontium-90 accumulated in them. It was found that the fallout from weapons testing fell on areas east of the Nevada test site and accumulated in the teeth of children. Since strontium-90 has the same behavior in our bodies as calcium, it is nicknamed the bone seeker, and its presence in our bones can lead to bone cancer and leukemia.
There was a woman, Dagmar Wilson, who was a children's book illustrator. And she was appalled by this, and she just started to gather up a following of women who were making phone calls, writing letters, and eventually women's strikes in several cities to bring attention to the nuclear testing that was happening and poisoning the groundwater. Malvina Reynolds wrote a song specifically about this, called What Have They Done to the Rain? And it was actually covered by Joan Baez, who called it the gentlest protest song ever sung. The actual protest wasn't gentle, right? The words were really powerful, but it's almost has a lullaby quality to it. And it is from the perspective of a little boy who is a downwinder. These elements would get blown downwind and sometimes affect the places downwind from the actual testing sites more than the actual testing sites, amazingly enough. And so as a downwinder, the rain falls. By the end of the song, the boy has died.
Oh.
It's a very tragic song, but beautiful melody.
So the melody definitely doesn't coincide with the words that are being sung.
No, it has a sadness to it, but it's sad, slow. It's not a harsh, angry song like we would find with some of the punk singers later on.
Okay.
But the work that she did and the other women who are working with this Women's Strike for Peace movement, including Joan Baez, it led to the signing of a treaty between the U.S. and the USSR, where they promised not to test nuclear weapons above ground or in the water. So Khrushchev and JFK signed that, I believe it was in 1963.
Yeah, 6 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated.
I believe it also covered In Outer Space.
Yeah, right.
Space as well. Wow.
Were these women also called communists for marching on Washington and requesting for them to stop destroying the land and poisoning children?
Yes, they were. So as part of that, these women were called before the House Subcommittee on Un-American Activities.
Wait, so exercising their legal right to protest was un-American?
That's how it was being framed. However, the press had a heyday with this. They were women's book illustrator, these housewives were being hauled before this trial. And it was one of the things, I believe, that led to House Subcommittee on Un-American Activities losing popularity because it was just seen as ridiculous.
That is pretty ridiculous.
Malvina Riddles actually wrote a song called the HUAC that parodies what happened to these women. I think that one of the amazing things that they did is they started this huge letter writing campaign. And they were not just writing to Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy. They were writing to their wives as well, saying, hey, women, you better stop your husbands from doing this because it's affecting other women. It was very successful and was given credit for the treaty that was signed.
That's a great idea.
It was successful. It worked. And that kind of letter writing, I think, is very reminiscent of the work that Amnesty International did with writing to different dictators who had political prisoners. And Joan Baez was responsible for initiating several of the chapters of Amnesty International, especially in the Southwest, I believe.
How does music from the Women's March connect with music from marches today?
That is a great question, because Malvina Reynolds had a daughter who also became a musician and worked with people in protests and was part of a group called the Occupellas. And the Occupellas sing at protests, especially associated with the Occupy movement, and they still work to train up singers how to use music within protests. And I would definitely say that the model of the Women's Strike for Peace March became a model for the women's marches that have happened, I would say most notably since around 2017, protesting some of the more recent issues. So absolutely, there are continuing trends. And I also see that a lot of songs are recycled through this. So for example, Joan Baez helped to cover a song called Bread and Roses, whose poem comes from a labor protest in the 1910s. And this song is picked up and used oftentimes in things like YouTube videos that are depicting what's happening in the women's marches of today. So you have this wonderful continuity of the labor strike and this beautiful song about how women are not just looking for daily bread, but also are looking for the chance to experience beauty and not just have their whole life dedicated to labor. In the 1910s, we know about the terrible working conditions in the factories, for example. And then Joan Baez and Mimi Farina come to this song in the 1960s and 70s, and then it comes back up in the 2010s and 2020s. So there's a longevity of these songs that connect these nodes across U.S. history, which I think is absolutely wonderful.
Part of me agrees with that. Like, wow, that's great. And another part is like, can't we fight for something else now? Why are we still fighting for the same things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we were talking about the framework, the phrasing, the rhetoric that is used today is often reflecting the same rhetoric in the 1950s and 60s. I would say part of the reason it does is that we're still working on some of the same difficult, thorny issues.
Yes, absolutely. We have these powerful women songwriters during the time who march in the Women's March, but there's also a period of time in which women are powerful in a different way, right? There's a lot of women and radiation in songs, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, these are some of the most hideous songs ever written, ever heard, ever recorded. So we'll have them in the book if you're interested in listening to them, but there's many of them are quite crass. Because in the atomic age, a lot of people had a spotty, incomplete understanding of what radiation actually does to the human body. There were a lot of atomic bomb tests that were shown on TV or in film reels, but they were from a great distance. And the footage that came out of Hiroshima and Nagasaki about the bomb victims there was censored. So this led to sort of a fantasy about what atomic power and what radiation can do to humans, you know, from the first bomb test. It wasn't just entertainment for adults. There's a whole industry of nuclear-themed toys for kids. There was a game called Uranium Rush. There were like Fallout Shelter cutout books and atomic disintegrating pistols and atomic energy kits. So there's this whole culture around atomic energy, and this also led to a lot of songs being written.
So what time period are we talking about?
We're talking about the late 40s to the early 60s. Thankfully, the Cuban Missile Crisis ended well. I think it woke people up about the real dangers of, truly the dangers of nuclear war. And then this type of fantasy about atomic energy sort of died down in the 60s. But all through the 50s, you had all these crazy songs being written about women who were bombshells because somehow they didn't make it into the fallout shelter and they grew a third arm or they have mushroom clouds exploding from their mouths and gamma rays coming out of their eyes. So you have these really crass songs.
Oh, is that where the term bombshell comes from in describing a woman even today?
I've looked into that. I'm sure it had a lot to do with it, but I couldn't figure that out for sure if that term came from comparing women to bombs. So you have songs like Radioactive Mama, Fallout Philly, My Radiation Baby, B-Bomb Baby, Atomic Baby, Atom Bomb Baby, Your Atom Bomb Heart, Fujiyama Mama, and it goes on and on.
Were they popular?
Somewhat. They never really made a dent on the charts. They were sort of novelty songs, you know, comic songs on like smaller labels. None of these were like mainstream hits. And they were sort of lost in time until a decade ago when YouTube came along and all these old 45s were being unearthed and then digitized and now you can find everything on YouTube. If I would have written this book 20 years ago, I would have never found any of these songs. It would have been very hard for me to find these songs.
Wow.
There's another category within that category of the bomb shelter as a makeout pad. So you bring your best girl down to the bomb shelter, sexist in its own way as well.
I never even thought of that, but of course, why not?
Yeah.
You sent me a document with pictures of a lot of different kids' toys at the time. And I have to say, my favorite by far is Little Lizzie's Fallout Shelter Playhouse.
Yes.
I want this playhouse. So, to describe it to our listeners, it is a dollhouse, but it is underground. There's literally dirt on top and on the sides and on the back. So it's completely underground. You can get weapons and treats and staple foods. And it says, create your own nuclear family. I know. It is amazing. I would love it. I would love to get this. And it looks big, unless the girl is very small. It would be amazing.
This total journey of writing this book, both of us have found many strange, weird, disturbing things about American history. And it's all sort of a commentary on the fact that we never experienced nuclear war here. I don't know much about Japanese culture and what played out there, but I don't think there's these type of things in Japanese culture and the way it flourished all the rest of the world. It shows the frivolity, the innocence, or naivete about the real dangers of atomic weapons. It's also a way to deal with it, make fun of it. And there's a lot of comic songs about the Cold War and nuclear weapons. It also shows the naivete of all of us about what we're dealing with.
It also shows the way that information was withheld from ordinary people. There's governmental pamphlets that absolutely downplay the dangers of nuclear radiation.
Do you find songs like this in other countries, or is it kind of an American phenomenon?
Well, we focus mostly on American and British songwriters. And to some extent, you would talk about Kraftwerk from Germany and U2 from Ireland, some Australian bands. We did not go global with this because this is too much. We found quite enough just from American and British songwriters. So I cannot answer that question.
Who knew you could say there are too many nuclear songs?
Yeah.
So I want to go back to the second time period that you talked about. You said there was a flurry of, well, you might not have said flurry. You said there was a lot of songs in the 80s.
Yeah.
This is the time period where communism was dying down a little bit. Do you think that this music influenced the popular opinion on nuclear disarmament in the U.S.?
I think it did to some extent. In the late 70s, there was a lot of talk about Russia has more missiles and bombs than we do. President Reagan got on this, and he greatly increased military spending during his first term, and England did also. So there was a lot of talk about MIRVs, these amazing nuclear weapons where one missile holds 12 missiles and they can float in the atmosphere and aim at different places. Like one bomb can shoot 12 bombs. All this was coming in, and when news got out, especially the British punks and the British heavy metal artists started to write a lot of songs. And they joined up with the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and they started playing at protest rallies. It was mostly the punks that wrote the majority of these songs. There was some mainstream rock performers and some heavy metal, but the punks just like went crazy. It was like this whole subculture of some bands, that's all they wrote about was nuclear weapons.
So who were some of these punk groups?
There was one called Crass, another called Discharge. Dead Man's Shadow.
That's a great name for a band. Dead Man's Shadow.
You can, exactly.
I mean, they must have just wrote nuclear songs.
Yes. This is a period when Brezhnev was still in power. Then he died. Then he had Andropov. In that period of 1980 to 1985, the Cold War was very cold. We were not speaking to the Russians. It was only until Gorbachev came along and Reagan really liked Gorbachev, and they really started to work together. That's when the number of songs started to die down, and there were more songs about, well, maybe the Russians are just regular people like us. Maybe it's only their dictators that are insane and crazy. In the late 80s, you're starting to hear songs about reconciliation and becoming neighbors in the global village instead of bitter enemies. So there was that whole dynamic, too, in the late 80s, with the tone shifted.
I remember correctly, Amnesty International plays a part again.
In the late 80s, they had the Human Rights Now tour, and there were a number of rock musicians, people like Sting, Bruce Springsteen, Bono, Tracy Chapman, as well as some folk musicians, Joan Baez, who came along for parts of the tour, around the world to bring attention to human rights violations. And this was a collaborative effort, but I think it was also a time when a lot of these musicians were exposed to world politics in a new way. So some of the things that were happening with the Cold War in South America, where we were helping to plant right-wing governmental officials in places we were afraid that would become another Cuba, that would move more towards left-wing communism. Their exposure to that led them to write songs about specific things that were happening in these areas.
Did music influence the Soviet Union at all?
Yes, and this is a really fascinating story. So like in the United States, there was no song that was a milestone song or a touchstone of a movement for non-proliferation or disarmament. There was no song against the bomb that had impact in the United States. When you think of the civil rights movement, you think of We Shall Overcome and what an important song that was in the civil rights movement. There was no song in America or in England that captured the imagination or the tenor of the times in the way that song did for the civil rights movement. But in the Soviet Union, ironically, music did play a factor in the decline of communism. In the 50s and 60s, young Soviet music fans wanted to hear songs from the West. Beatle records were smuggled in and disseminated. Young Soviet music fans found a way to copy Western records onto discarded X-ray plates.
Okay, hold on. So these X-ray plates aren't what we think of when we go to hospitals today and get an X-ray. They have to be something different, right?
Yeah, well, they would go around to hospitals and just dig through the bins for discarded X-rays. I'm not sure what material they're made from, but they were close enough to vinyl that you could actually, they also made these lays where it would copy the groove on the record and make an exact copy of it onto the X-ray plate. So the X-ray plate became the record.
Oh, okay. I get it. I was trying to figure out what that would look like, but the X-ray actually became a record.
Yeah. So just imagine how cool this is. You have this X-ray of like bones, the interiors of Soviet people. You don't know who they are. It's just like bones, like a skull. But it's a rock record also. I mean, this must have been so cool. You know,
it's pretty cool, yeah.
Your average 20-year-old who loves music. So it created this whole underground culture of what were called records on bones or X-ray records, where they would be traded, and it was all kept underground. But it led to the formation of hundreds of Soviet rock bands. All through the 60s and 70s, these scenes would erupt. The police would come in and break up any concerts, and X-ray records were confiscated. And this rock culture never really surfaced in a mainstream way until like the 80s, when things started to die down when Gorbachev came into power. The really interesting thing is that Mikhail Gorbachev, one of these young kids in the 50s and 60s, so he grew up in a generation different from your Lenins or your Khrushchevs or your Brezhnevs. He was the next generation. He loved the Beatles, even as a 20 or 30-year-old. When he got to meet Paul McCartney for the first time, he was stunned. It's ironic that the person who had come to power in the 80s is someone who was not listening to the right music. He was not following the party line. It would take someone like him, someone from the inside, you know, an insider, to shift the national psyche towards glasnost and towards perestroika, towards a more freedom of expression, more allowance of government scrutiny. These X-ray records were like one of those inklings that happened that led to Soviet citizens accepting and dreaming of a more freedom, which they got, you know, in 1991 when communism fell.
It might just be that my house is cold, but I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about how much music can play in liberating people.
Yeah. The strangest thing about these X-ray records, they sounded horrible. I have to read you a really funny quote. A Soviet record collector, his name was Kolya Vazin. He described the sound of these records as, quote, listening through sand. It was like you had music playing in one ear and someone crunching biscuits in the other. So they were very scratchy. They skipped. It was like all this surface noise. But it was still, they heard the electric guitar and the drums and the bass and the singing. They probably didn't understand a word of English. So they didn't listen to them for the lyrics. They just listened for the sound, just the sound of electric rock, which was this amazing foreign thing, which was not in their culture. Of course, it was forbidden. They were not allowed to listen to such music, so it was all the more tempting.
And during this time, there were a few stars that were invited to come behind the curtain. One of them was Bruce Springsteen, who in 1988 was working with the Amnesty International Human Rights Now tour. And in East Berlin, they saw that the young people were getting a little restless and were falling in love with this rock and roll. And so they actually invited Springsteen to come perform a concert in East Berlin. And there were hundreds of thousands who attended. They actually don't even know how many attended because people just walked right by the ticket booths and filled up entire field. Some people think there might have been as many as 300 to 400,000 people there.
Wow.
And it was a touchstone moment. One of the songs he sang, which was also a huge part of the Amnesty International tour, was Bob Dylan's song from the 1960s, Chimes of Freedom Flashing, which if you go through that, it's a very dense, beautiful song. But if you look at the lyrics, it is about all of the people who are forgotten or who are oppressed or pushed down. And as part of his concert, he wanted to read a statement before singing this song. Part of the statement was he dreamed of the day when all walls would be torn down. And his translator said, no, you absolutely cannot say that at this time and place. So he changed the word in German to barriers. I dream of the day when all barriers will be pulled down. And he read this in German. So it was this beautiful moment. And I would say that even though we don't have a specific song that became an anthem in the U.S. specifically about nuclear weapons and warfare, there were a couple of Bob Dylan songs that, though created in one of these earlier periods, became touchstones during this time. So Chimes of Freedom Flashing is one of these songs, but also Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released became an anthem of the Human Rights Now tour. And both of those are resonant with these big picture human rights, value of freedom, and I think were really wonderful touchstone moments as they were recycled from their original context.
And I think a lot of our listeners would definitely know who
Absolutely.
Bob Dylan is. Or if not, they need to go check Bob Dylan out.
Absolutely. There's an obscure little song by Bob Dylan I'd like to touch on for a moment, and it's his response to the bomb shelter. So in his chronicles, he talks about living in this small town with his family, and there were door-to-door bomb shelter salespeople who would come and try to talk people into building a bomb shelter. And his entire community said, well, if I do that, what will happen to my neighbors? Like, this is going to cause such bad blood between us. If I have a bomb shelter just for my family and my neighbor comes knocking and I say, so sorry, we don't have room. The beautiful song is called Let Me Die in My Footsteps. And the chorus is, let me die in my footsteps before I go down under the ground. In many ways, seems like a response to Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land, because he talks about the beauty of nature and walking above ground rather than burying yourself below ground while you're still alive. And it's just resonant with all of these metaphors. Gorgeous little song.
Tim, you mentioned before about kind of humor in nuclear war. And I want to talk about probably my favorite musician in your book, who is Tom Lehrer. Can you tell our listeners who he is and about his musical style?
Yeah, sure. Tom Lehrer, he's considered to be one of the greatest musical satirists in the 20th century. He's still alive. He's over 90. He began writing his songs when he was a student at Harvard University in the 1950s. So he earned a degree in mathematics, and then he was accepted into the doctoral program, but he never finished his degree. He had a multifaceted career. He was in the U.S. Army. He composed songs for television shows and recorded albums and performed as a solo artist. And he also still worked as a professor and taught mathematics. One of his most famous songs, which some people might know, is called The Elements. And in the song, he simply goes through the whole periodic table of the elements and makes it into a song. And if you go on YouTube, you can find Daniel Radcliffe of Harry Potter fame loves this song. So he memorized the song, and Daniel Radcliffe has performed it on various television shows, and he just raves about how much he loves Tom Lehrer.
What are some of the songs he wrote about the Cold War nuclear weapons?
Yeah, he wrote several songs about those subjects. His first is called The Wild West is Where I Want to Be, and it pairs cowboy music with recounting the nuclear tests that were happening at the Nevada test site and just in the western deserts. We can all just go out west and catch us a nuclear bomb test. Another one of his songs is called Who's Next, and it sort of recounts the sequence of events during the arms race. And what's interesting about that song, with every country, every verse, he modulates up a half step. So as you listen to the song, you're hearing more and more tension as these continual modulations ramp up the tension in the song. And it really reflects well how complicated things got very quickly as soon as 8 or 9 countries got the bomb.
First we got the bomb, and that was good, 'cause we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, 'cause the balance of power's maintained that way. Who's next? France got the bomb, but don't you grieve, 'cause they're on our side, I believe. China got the bomb, but have no fears, they can't wipe us out for at least 5 years. Who's next? Then Indonesia claimed that they were going to get one any day. South Africa wants two, that's right. One for the black and one for the white. Who's next? Egypt's gonna get one too, just to use on you know who. So Israel's getting tense, wants one in self-defense. The Lord is our shepherd, says the psalm, but just in case, we better get a bomb. Who's next? A Luxembourg is next to go, and who knows, maybe Monaco. We'll try to stay serene and calm when Alabama gets the bomb. Who's next? Who's next? Who's next? Who's next?
And it ends on a very funny note, the last verses. We'll all try to stay serene and calm when Alabama gets the bomb. And the song's from 1965. Now, when I first heard the song, I'm like, why is he naming all these countries that want atomic weapons? And then he ends with Alabama. And then the more I looked into it, a lot of bad things happened in Alabama in the early 60s with civil rights. You know, you had
Of course.
George Wallace in his inauguration speech when he became governor saying segregation forever. And then he stood out at the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama and didn't want African Americans to register. And then the Selma Montgomery March. So Tom Lehrer was good. He could do multiple subjects at once. He could write a song about the arms race and then end with a commentary about the civil rights movement.
This is all really kind of dark and heavy material, but was the tone of his songs dark or were they kind of happy and upbeat?
Well, that's the interesting thing about his songs. He wrote about dark subjects, but he always had happy, fun music. So that's where his satire comes out. One of his most famous Cold War songs is called We will all go together when we go.
That, by the way, is my maybe all-time favorite song. I will just dance around the house to that song.
Yeah, it's sort of a sardonic celebration of, we're all going to die in a nuclear war. Isn't this awesome? Though it starts out like in a minor key and like a very slow tempo, like a funereal mood. He starts thinking about how sad funerals are, how sad it is when someone dies. But then when he starts talking about the bomb, it goes to a major key. And he says, the bomb is just so awesome because we'll all die at once and we won't have to grieve each other because there'll be nobody left to grieve. We'll all die together and it'll be so fun. It'll be great. He uses all kind of crazy metaphors to describe people burned by radiation, charred steak and barbecue. And it's a horrible, funny song.
And I mean, that is one way to deal with something that's really horrific, right? Is humor.
Yeah, we have a whole chapter in the book about humorous songs about the Cold War. And we call it comedy and novelty songs. The Cold War is a big joke.
So along with humor in songs, I think that throughout we can see humor as a form of protest, and we could look at this broadly. One of the women songwriters who was writing during one of these early periods, the 1960s, but continued to write throughout her career and even is writing songs into the present is Peggy Seeger. Peggy Seeger is the half-sister of Pete Seeger, and she has spent a lot of her life living in Great Britain, partly because her work led her to travel in the Soviet Union at a time when you really weren't supposed to be doing that, and eventually because of her outward stance, and especially the tension on her half-brother, Pete Seeger, she ended up getting her passport revoked. And after a complicated series of stories, ended up marrying another folk singer, Ewan McCall. Now, her early folk songs or protest songs also have to do with nuclear proliferation. But later on in the 80s, she was talking about the dangers of nuclear energy and also the fact that the U.S. was using Great Britain as a storage place for some of our nuclear weapons. And people were so frustrated with this that they started to protest in the way that they paid their bills, especially their electric bill. They would pay everything except for the part that would go to nuclear energy. And on top of that, apparently there's this loophole where in Great Britain, at least at the time, you didn't have to write your check on an actual check. So people started to write their electric bill checks on cows.
Wait, what?
They would write their check on a cow and send it to the bank. They would write it on cakes. She wrote one of her checks on a cake, which apparently might have gotten eaten. And she also wrote one on a rotten egg that got returned to her very carefully.
This is a great form of protest, but I am just curious on how checks work in Great Britain that you don't have to use a bank-issued check. That's just crazy.
As long as you have the routing number, apparently.
Wow.
I don't know if that still holds true today. You would think that after that, they would have learned their lesson.
Yeah, I'm betting they closed that loophole pretty fast after after a cow and
the
a rat.
Yeah,
the cow loophole. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty amusing. But they had a very serious point behind it. One of Peggy Seeger's more serious songs is called The 4-Minute Warning. In Great Britain, they estimated 4 minutes if a nuclear weapon was shot off from the USSR. And it deals with the fallout, the point of entry, and then as the nuclear fission spreads, right? She counts down the minutes and what's happening, naming all of these areas in Great Britain that are slowly dissolved under the force of the nuclear weapon. And she states that the song is to be sung in exactly 4 minutes.
That is depressing.
It is very depressing. It's a very grim song. So she had both of those people in her, this person who could write this very humorous protest stuff, as well as very grim, direct looks at what the actual effects will be.
I was just thinking that we didn't think we had a lot of time with 7 minutes.
Right.
But the UK, I didn't realize, had 4 minutes. That's not enough time to do anything.
Well, they made a joke. It's just enough time to boil an egg.
Honestly, at this point, there's no good way to transition into anything else. We just spoke about certain death in 4 minutes from nuclear war, but there's more stories to be told and more topics to discuss, so consider this your transition. At the end of the Cold War, there's this unlikely musician, kind of becomes a hero of the Eastern Bloc.
Yes, especially in Germany. And his name is David Hasselhoff.
That just doesn't make any sense to kind of people in the U.S.
Yeah. For any David Hasselhoff fans out there, just calm down, sit down. Just, we can tell you a little story here. So we all know David Hasselhoff. He was the star of Knight Rider, The Talking Car, and then Baywatch, Hunk. He was also a singer, put out a few albums. But he became very popular in Germany, both East and West, in the 70s and 80s. People watched Knight Rider in Germany and loved it. So in 1989, his record producer and manager brought him the song called Looking for Freedom. And it was a song written several years before. It was originally a German song with a different title. But he decided to record it, Looking for Freedom, and it became a big hit in the summer of 1989. The Hoff was already a big star in Germany, and he was invited to sing the song on New Year's Eve, 1989. I can't remember the venue, but David Hasselhoff said, well, I want to sing it on the Berlin Wall. And of course, we know what happened to the Berlin Wall in November. That's when the border was opened and the Cold War was definitely winding down. That was one of the main signs that the Cold War was ending, the Berlin Wall. Is no more. It's still standing, but it's just a wall now. So he got his wish. There was this big celebration on New Year's Eve, 1989. And there he was at the Berlin Wall. And they put him up in this big bucket crane above the crowd, which was tens and tens of thousands of people cheering. And they played the backing track of the song, and he sung it live. And he was wearing this amazing, sparkly leather jacket, had all these lights on it, and it was one of the weirdest moments in Cold War musical history. David Hasselhoff singing the song at the Berlin Wall. And what's really funny is that what happened earlier, maybe a few days before, is that the famous conductor Leonard Bernstein was asked to put on performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, both in East and West Berlin, which he did. And he decided that he wanted to change the title of the choral section in the fourth movement. Instead of An die Freude, you know, Ode to Joy, he changed the wording to An die Freiheit, Ode to Freedom. But that Ode to Freedom, that was not the song everybody was singing on that day. Everybody was singing Looking for Freedom by David Hasselhoff. So Beethoven, I'm sure, like Chuck Berry said, he was rolling in his grave because David Hasselhoff was a bigger star that night than Beethoven was. So that's one of the crazy stories we came across in writing the book.
And I think that shows how much of an impact popular music has in our lives, actually.
Yeah. And the Hoff, he admitted, I was just the right person at the right time with the right song.
That leads me to my next question, which is, what is the most popular Cold War song that dealt with nuclear weapons? What is a song our listeners may know?
One of the most popular is 99 Red Balloons by Nina.
Wait, that's a song about nuclear weapons?
Maybe not specifically about nuclear weapons, but definitely about a world war, World War III. Nina was a West German band in the 80s. They wrote this song. It came out in 1983. It was a big hit all over the world, and even in America, the German version hit number one. the lyrics were translated into English, and that was also a hit. But the German version was a worldwide hit. It's a really concise retelling of what might happen if someone makes a bad call on like a red alert or a possible launching of a missile. So the song starts out about telling about we have some balloons and we're just going to let them fly into the air, and someone in some missile base sees them and says, oh, what are these things? You better call my superiors. And the superiors look at, oh, wonder what those are, the foreign missiles? I better call the president. And it just goes right up the chain of command. And the president sends out some 99 jet fighters. And the jet fighters see, oh, it's just balloons. But we're going to shoot them down anyways, just because here we are, might as well shoot them down. And then the enemy sends out their jet fighters. And then a world war ensues. And it lasts for 99 years. And everyone is complete destruction on all sides. And then the song ends where the singer is just walking through the ruins and finds a balloon and lets the balloon go. So the song is about false alarms.
I had no idea that that's what the song was about. I think everybody just kind of knows the refrain and knows that it's a catchy tune. I don't remember ever actually listening to the lyrics. How does listening to music help us understand the Cold War time period?
I think listening to these songs helps us to see things from the point of view of ordinary people. Some of my research has focused on social history, the history of people on the ground, what they're experiencing, rather than the earlier top-down kinds of history making. Who was the king? Who was the president? What was the name of the battle in the battlefield? By looking at the ordinary experience of individual people, we can recover these perspectives. So for example, when we were talking about how the 1950 songs often had a different tone to them because they didn't have the same information that they had in the 1960s. I think that's a very important way of recovering voices. I think it also is a good model for us how songs can tie together emotion, narrative, and information. We can think of songs as being emotional, but they also are really good ways of conveying information and also joining together people's empathy with information. There are reasons that songs are used in protests over and over again, right? They help us to enter somebody else's point of view. They give us a sense of the emotions that someone might experience. When we get to songs like Billy Joel's Leningrad, where he got to travel to the USSR and met a man who was a clown who became one of his very close friends. And he reflects in that song of how they both had the same experiences of the Cold War, fear, raising children, and they shared a friendship now. We get to enter into that relationship through the power of song.
It's a shame that so many of these songs are still relevant. We think the Cold War ended in 1991. In some ways, the Cold War has never ended. It continues to go on. And some of these songs show that.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to Tim and Joanna. It was a lot of fun talking about music with them. And as always, thanks to Lexi Weghorn for her help with this podcast. You can access the Spotify song list and YouTube links on our website, mynuclearlife.com. For bonus content, find us on Patreon, and make sure you share us with a friend. I'm going to leave you with my favorite Tom Lehrer song, We Will All Go Together When We Go. Join me next time. I'm Shelley Lesher, and this has been My Nuclear Life.
I always like to end on a positive note, so here is a rousing, uplifting song which is guaranteed to cheer you up. When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth we'll someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go, every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.